The second case for oral argument this morning is in the matter of the estate of Rosania M. Stewart, deceased. For the appellants, we have Mr. Terry Sutton, an attorney from Watertown, and Mr. Gregory Graycheck, an attorney from Milbank. My understanding that Mr. Sutton, you'll be speaking first for 10 minutes, and then Mr. Graycheck, you'll speak for 10 minutes. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then for the same for the rebuttal, except it will be 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And for the appellee, we have Mr. David Strait, an attorney from Watertown. Very well, Mr. Sutton, you may proceed, sir, and you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning, Mr. Strait. Judge, I represent, justices, I represent Peter Stewart and Patricia Mitchell, the two surviving children of Rosina Stewart. Judge, this was a case that arose out of a will. And a will contest, of course, as the court is aware, and also a subsequent codicil amending the original will. The will was originally drawn back in December of 2001. At the time that that will was drawn, Rosina was an 86-year-old female who had some ill health issues. She suffered from hypothyroidism as a result of Hashimoto's disease, and in fact had her thyroid, in effect, killed by the use of iodine-131. So as a result, she was required to take ongoing thyroid supplements. She also suffered from congestive heart failure, and because of that congestive heart failure, she had chronic edema, swelling, and because of that, she was prescribed Lasix as to remove the fluid from her body. She was not compliant with that. And because of the non-compliance, she ended up, over the course of several years, hospitalized a number of times. She also demonstrated a series of confusion. And in fact, in early 2002, a guardianship of both a person and a conservatorship was authorized by the court. Now, the will, so that the court understands, there are two separate provisions. The first is the original will in December of 2001. The effect of that will was to leave about 195 acres of real estate to two sons of Rosina, those two being Alan Sr. and Edward. At the time that Rosina made the will in 2001, she had four children, Patricia and Patty, my clients, and two additional children, Edward and Alan. She had a fifth child, Kathleen, who predeceased Rosina. Kathleen died in the mid-90s, did not have any children. Kathleen had lived with Rosina for a long period of time. Rosina's husband was killed in a corn picker accident in the 1950s. And in fact, my client, Peter, at 11 years of age, I think the testimony would show from the record, came home from school and found his father caught in the corn picker. And so Rosina ended up raising five children alone raised these children on a farm and ranch just a little bit west of Roberts County up in the hills. The two children, my children, grew up. Patricia went to Minneapolis. Peter was raised in Minneapolis and ultimately got a job and went to work for the Burlington Northern Railroad and worked on the railroad. After Kathleen died, Peter retired from the railroad, initially came back home to provide help to mom, Rosina. Rosina had some serious health problems even then. And in about 1996, Peter came back home and moved on the farm, moved in the house to help mom. In 1996, then, Peter also bought some cattle and raised cattle on the farm and helped on the ranch and helped out. Ultimately, a dispute arose. Peter did that for about 5 years. And a dispute arose with mom. Ultimately, Peter sold the cattle and moved about 4 or 5 miles away from the home place and then still provided some assistance. That continued on, Peter kept providing some help. Providing help around the farm place, had a tractor there, had some equipment. Ultimately, in 2000, roughly 2000 or 2001, Rosina started having some serious health problems. About that point in time, she apparently decided to put together a will. But first, in advance of doing that, she originally started with 275 acres of real estate. On 80 acres, there was also her house and her building site. Now, her house and building site were very important to her. I mean, she lived in that same farm place essentially since the estate of her husband was resolved back in the 50s. And she would do anything to try and not be removed from the farm place. But what she ended up doing is selling the house and the surrounding 80 acres to Edward and to Alan on a contract for deed. The purpose for that sale was, in effect, to obtain some money to allow Mom to rehabilitate the home. But the net effect of the sale was to put the control of the home in Edward and Alan. And that was actually done in November of 2001, right before the will that was drawn in December of 2001 was drawn.
Just to get where you're going, I see two issues. One that you've cited in your brief is undue influence, and the other is testamentary capacity. And your first sentence under your standard of review was that these are questions of fact, and the standard of review was clearly erroneous.
That's true.
You recited facts to us. Why don't you tell us what you think the trial court did wrong in determining the facts?
Well, I think the trial court was wrong, and I think that the biggest there are three telling facts, but I think the biggest one is the trial court, in effect, first of all, didn't allow any briefing. It made a bench decision. But beyond the bench decision, what it ended up doing, this particular will, is drawn by Gordon Nielsen, the attorney involved, was the first will he had ever recorded. And there's an audio recording, and that's been received as exhibit number one. That audio recording provides some evidence, both at least to consider with regard to Rosina's competency and what she was able to do. And if you listen to that audio recording, it's our position that audio recording doesn't meet the statutory, clearly, erroneously, doesn't meet the statutory requirements for competency. That is, she wasn't able to recite without prompting who the reasonable bounty of her property would be. Beyond that, she referred to herself by her maiden name. She wasn't even aware of her own name, in effect. She used the maiden name Kathleen Lynch. And the testimony at trial established for years that she'd been known as Rosina Stewart with the children. So our view is that the evidence before the court is clear, before the trial court is clearly erroneous based on the tape itself. The other part of that is that the proffered reason for this entire estate plan was essentially to generate money. But the net effect of this estate plan didn't generate any money for Rosina. It put control of what she wanted to keep in Alan and Edward.
I thought she also wanted to keep the farm and the family. Wasn't that a goal too?
Ultimately, that's correct. Yeah, that was one of her stated goals. But the most important, it was the house itself originally, and certainly the related ground was a part of it as well. But the house and her home, she did not want to leave the home. And she, as the briefing reflects, would leave kicking and screaming, including one time literally. It was later on, it was about 2005 or 6, but she ended up physically fighting with emergency personnel who were going to take her to a nursing facility.
You know, you have those two points, but didn't the trial court have to balance those against the testimony of the other witnesses that said she did have testamentary capacity?
Yes.
Well, then, how do we get by clearly erroneous when the trial court had to balance the two points you raise against all of the other witness testimony?
Well, I think there's two issues, and perhaps I'm And I'll come back to the other issue first. But the reality of it is, it's true that, that there is a balancing test, but it's also, this court does have the clearly erroneous standard to look at. And that does give the court a second opportunity to look at the evidence. Okay? Second, in my view, and most importantly on issue two, the court really didn't make any findings on undue influence. There was no decision. I mean, there was no briefing. There was, at best, there was a statement during the, at least the oral pronouncement of the undue that there was.
What about finding 48?
And that's the sole basis, as the brief says, the sole basis for the finding that there was no undue influence. The court did not address the elements of undue influence specifically.
Your time has expired, Mr. Sutton. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Grychuk, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The children of Edward Stewart Jr. are here today to contest the codicil executed July 21st, 2006. Barely 1 month after the death of their father, only 3 months after she saw mountain lions behind her stereo, and only 4 days before lab reports confirmed in a panic alert that she wasn't taking her prescribed medication, medication that kept her from suffering from edema, swelling, fluid buildup, and mentation changes. These are facts in the record that are virtually indisputable and uncontested. We need to begin, I believe, our analysis with determining the impact of the trial court's failure to consider the issue of the presumption of abuse. The trial court just didn't consider it. Didn't discuss it in its the trial court's decision on the record, and didn't discuss it in the findings and conclusions. Yet the evidence on the issue of presumption of abuse, we would contend, is likewise indisputable. Alan Stewart Sr., Rosina's son, was clearly in a confidential relationship with his mother. All of the testimony that exists on the issue reflects he was the person she turned to manage her finances, to make her decisions, big or small. In fact, the guardian's husband couldn't even fix her telephone because she had to wait for Alan to come and take care of it for her. Clearly, a confidential relationship existed. Alan Stewart Sr. likewise participated in the participation of the codicil. When the call was made to the lawyer's office to have a codicil drafted up, it wasn't made by Rosina Stewart. It was made by Alan Stewart. He called the lawyer and said, call Mama and get her will revised. One phone call resulted. The next visit, rapidly, was to execute the codicil out at the farm. Alan Stewart Sr., on the evidence that's before the court in the record, clearly directed the change of the personal representative. Mr. Nielsen testified he couldn't recall who told him this information, but the personal representative said, yeah, well, I was my dad's personal representative, so that's why it was done. I was picked as new personal representative. Alan Stewart Sr. arranged for the execution of the codicil, and rather than bring Mama to the lawyer's office where she could be taken in private and discussed in private and gone over all the elements, the lawyer came out to the farm, sat at the kitchen table, put the documents in front of her, had her read it. Alan Stewart Sr. was present at the time the execution was done. At a time when he normally would be in Minneapolis, he's in South Dakota waiting for the lawyer to get there. Takes the lawyer in, says, Mama, the lawyer's here to get the paper signed. And then he steps outside and waits until they're done. Then he goes back in to make sure there were no problems, that it was signed. And then he leaves to go fishing, which is what his goal was that day. So he did actively participate in the preparation and execution of the will. Alan Stewart Sr. likewise unduly profited in a will that had gifted her property 50-50 between the two children that she wanted to leave her estate to, predominantly to 50-50. It was changed after this to provide what would I would contend is more like an 85-15 split, giving all of the real estate at a depressed value to Alan Stewart Sr. or his family, and a stipend amount to the other family at this point. Clearly, I think the evidence demonstrates that a presumption of abuse arises. Therefore, because the trial court didn't address it, we're stumped at this point how to proceed. I think we could also contend, and do contend, that there was no evidence presented by the proponents to rebut the presumption. The only theory...
Isn't that the real issue? Because a presumption goes away once you have evidence to rebut it, and the judge looks like he's got quite a bit of evidence to weigh here. Aren't we really looking at the bottom line rather than a presumption?
Well, if there's evidence available to the court, although we don't know if there is evidence he considers rebutting a presumption or not because he didn't recognize a presumption, so we have to speculate at this point, and the court on review would be stuck with speculating. The question then is there evidence available to rebut a presumption of abuse? We would contend there isn't that evidence. The only theory advanced by proponents to rebut the presumption was that Rosina made a codicil taking the property, the real estate, from a family member in order to keep the property in the family. A completely nonsensical reason. That would hardly be sufficient to rebut the presumption.
What evidence, remind me what evidence you would have presented that he would have actually participated in the preparation and execution of the will, that particular part of it. How did he participate in the preparation and execution of the will?
He contacted the attorney to have a codicil drafted. He gave information to the attorney about who the personal representative should be. He contacted the attorney to provide for the execution of the will, to set up the execution of the will, and then he was there to take the attorney in to have the document signed. All of those factors indicate he was involved in that. Just as this court stated in the matter of Bush,
what was the evidence that he gave the information? I thought the attorney indicated he did not recall that Alan gave the information.
He didn't recall where it came from directly. That's
all
correct.
Right. You said there was information that he gave it to him. What is that?
The personal representative testified that the personal representative was changed because Dad had his personal representative, that is, Alan Stewart Sr.'s personal representative, Alan Stewart Jr., named as the personal representative. That was how the determination of who would be the new personal representative was made. As this court stated in the matter of Borsch,
And that's enough that you think that the court could have concluded they participated in the preparation?
Same
with the personal representative?
Well,
I thought you're more concerned about who gets the property. What evidence, was there any evidence of that, of undue influence on how she distributed it?
As this court stated in matter of Borsch, there is no direct proof of undue influence. There seldom is. Just like in a criminal conspiracy, you don't invite people to come and watch. You have to look at the surrounding circumstance. Did somebody put a camera on Alan Stewart Sr. and see him tell Mama, this is what you're going to do? No. That doesn't exist. Do we have sufficient circumstance surrounding the execution of this will to show that he actively participated in it? We would contend yes, there is. A lot of evidence is circumstance to show that he participated. Undue influence.
Wasn't there a lot of evidence as well that she was strong-willed and wasn't about to listen to anybody?
There was evidence that she was a strong-willed, stubborn woman. But it was what she was strong-willed and stubborn about that we contend provides evidence that she was susceptible to influence. Her insistence was that she would stay in her house. She would do just about anything to stay in her house. And yet, since 2002, they had repeatedly dragged her from that house, kicking and screaming against her will, when they decided she needed to be in a nursing home or needed medical care. She knew, without the care or support of the family member that was giving her that care and support, she would not be able to have her one goal in life met. Therefore, yes, she's stubborn about wanting to stay in her home, but to be able to meet that goal, she had to give in or be susceptible to the whims of Alan Stewart Sr. We believe that the strongest evidence of undue influence is the dichotomy between the two will signings. During her original will, she planned for 6 months. She called a personal representative. She met with two different lawyers, a real estate appraiser. She drafted a contract for deed ahead of time. And then she went to the lawyer's office and discussed all of the facts and circumstances. On the codicil, in barely 1 month's time, she talked to the lawyer on the phone one time. She drafted or signed the codicil that allows the personal representative to sell the property if he wants, which is contrary to her primary goal. And she signed a codicil that said that she's a he, when we clearly know she's not. And she wouldn't have signed that if she had read it and knew what it said. The rush to judgment or rush to signing this codicil is clear evidence that something was being done other than her will was being honored. The second most strongest evidence is she never told anybody about it.
Thank you, Mr. Graycheck. Your time has expired. Mr. Strait, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you and good morning. Rosina died at age 91. Her husband died in 1950, leaving her with five kids, the oldest of which was 11. She never remarried. She raised these five kids on her own, and she did it without government assistance. So it's not surprising we come to the end of her life, and she is described by everybody. It doesn't matter if it's the great-grand or the grandkids, the kids, the guardian, her doctor, Gordon Nielsen, described her as stubborn, bullheaded, opinionated, somebody that you're not going to influence. She's going to do what she wants to do, end of story. She lived on a small acreage just outside of Sisseton. It was off the main road, very hard to get to. But she lived there by herself her whole life. Up to the point the will was signed in 01, she was living there on her own. Now, she had a fall, I think, in 02 and had to be hospitalized for a while. In late December of 05, she had some heart problems and had to be hospitalized. But we come to 06, January of 06, from that point until late February of 07, she's on this farm taking care of herself. She had people checking on her periodically, but she's living on her own. She is taking her medication. She is physically able to do it. So, this is one tough lady. She started this estate planning process back in the summer of 01, and the first thing she did was round up Craig Ash to help her. Craig had to bow out because he was representing Peter. So they get this appraiser out there to put a value on the land. 80 acres of the land, the house site, the home site itself, is sold off to son Alan and son Edward. Now, contrary to what's stated in their brief, if you look on the contract for deed of November 2nd, 2001, Rosina retained for herself a life estate in this house. She had control of the house. The purpose of the selling it, it's been said that it was to raise money. Don't know exactly for what. I have my own speculation on that. I mean, I think Rosina's one of these people that says, you know what, nobody's going to take this house from me, and the way I'm going to do it, is I'm going to sell this to my kids, and then they're going to have control of it.
Does the record indicate whether any cash actually changed hands?
Well, I think that if you look in the reports by Carol Schotte, it shows that the payments are being made. She filed annual reports in her conservatorship ended in August of 04. Prior to that time, she was keeping track of the money, and the accounting does show that the payments are being made. I don't know if the initial down payment of $10,000 was made. I didn't find that one, but it was nobody disputed the fact that the payments were being made. Anyway, so Gordon Nielsen prepares his contract for deed, and then he goes on to prepare a will for her. And he did do an audio recording of it, and I believe you have that recording. And he did it because he said he was tipped off that, you know, this is a family that fights. Now, I think this recording is very, very, very important piece of information here. In that recording, Mr. Sutton says a problem is she called herself Lynch. The recording starts out by Gordon Nielsen saying, "Rosina, what's your legal name?" And she goes, "Huh? What's your legal name?" And she goes, "Rosina Lynch." And then he goes, "Well, you go by Stuart now, don't you?" "Well, yeah, I go by Stuart now." Now, somebody of that age may very well think that, you know, their legal name is their maiden name. And Rosina, in some of her the hospital records, she indicates that her former name is Lynch. So I don't think there's a lot of significance in the fact that she called herself Lynch. But that tape goes on, and she talks about each one of her kids. She talks about why she's going to give Peter less, why she's going to give Patty less. And Peter apparently up to a certain point in around 2000 or so was farming her land or raising cattle, but not paying her. Patty is the daughter that, and here's a really important piece of that tape, and I think it's sort of passed over. She says, she's talking about what she wants to do with this land. And she says, you know, Patty grew up in the cities, has been there since she was in the ninth grade. Patty came to see her. She was there in 1990, 2001, and then once in 11 years. I think there was a total of twice over 15 years. And she says, Rosina says on this tape, if Patty has this land, she's just going to sell it off and split the money. And to Rosina, that was, keeping it together was so important, because her next comments are, look, if this was land that my father acquired in 1933, and then she bought it off the estate, I think in 1959 or thereabouts. So that tape is a very important thing to listen to, because it tells the whole story of her thought process of what was important to her. Gordon Nielsen was the lawyer at the time. He was 100% convinced that she knew what she had for family, she knew what she had for assets, and she was very adamant about what she wanted to do with them. And there was nobody influencing her to make this decision. This was her decision. So the will gets executed in December of 01. 1 year goes by, and then the fight is on. Peter petitions to be the conservator, and Patty, the guardian. Now, they can say, well, this is all a secret. We didn't know that there was a will. This is part of the record. The court took judicial notice of the guardianship proceeding. January 3rd, 2003, he filed it. Kerry Cameron files a brief. Page 4 of that brief, he says that Patty's objective is to move Rosina to Bowie, Minnesota. Patty runs an assisted living facility of some sort. So Patty's going to move her over there. Peter's going to take care of the money. Well, they've got control of her. Now, Rosina didn't like that. She fought this and fought this. That brief also says they know that there is a will, and that Alan and Edward are the beneficiaries of that will. This guardianship proceeding, the court took judicial notice of it, and it's very important to realize these two facts. The lawyer through the guardianship proceeding was Gordon Nielsen, the same lawyer that did the will, the same lawyer that did the codicil. The judge was Judge Flemmer, the same one that oversaw the probate proceeding. There are four hearings. Rosina testified at two of those hearings. And I'd encourage you to listen to the transcript from the hearing in August of 03, because Rosina testifies, and she gets asked some questions, and the judge makes a decision. And then Rosina isn't going to stand for this. She wasn't going to let Judge Flemmer tell her what to do. So then she engages in discussion, I'll call it, with Judge Flemmer. In that guardianship proceeding twice, in August of 03 and August of 04, Judge Flemmer said, Rosina, you're competent. I find you competent. They're twisting the fact that there was a guardianship into something real significant here. It's not, because Judge Flemmer says, he says, look, and he said this in the probate file, you guys are taking out of context what was done here. I did this so that she would have somebody to take her to her appointments and somebody to make sure she's taking her medicine. In August of 04, he terminated the conservatorship, so from August of 04 on, all we have is a very limited guardianship for medical purposes. That's it. Rosina handled the finances from 04 to the end. In that guardianship, Carol Schotte was a very good guardian. She was a very meticulous person. She filed reports. At the end of each year, she filed a report that said, Rosina has a very sharp mind. November of 04, 4 months after the, November of 06, 4 months after the codicil is signed, Carol's report said, this lady has a very sharp mind for a 91-year-old. Her mentation was never, ever in question. August of 04, Dr. Judy Beamer, I hope I'm pronouncing her name right, I call her Dr. Judy, did a competency eval. And it's a mini one, it's Exhibit 10. To have a case of moderate dementia, you'd have to score a 20. Maximum score is 30. Rosina scored a 27. Where she failed, I mean, she was tested long-term memory, short-term memory. She had to hold a piece of paper in her hand, fold it up in a certain way, and then set it down. Where she made a mistake is Dr. Judy wasn't sure if she had to count backwards from 99 by sevens or if it was spell the word world backwards. But she got that wrong. And then there was another test where she had to have two intersecting pentagons that she had to look at, and she had to draw them, and she didn't quite get that right. But apparently she did get right the part where she has to close her eyes and write, you know, was it close your eyes and write a sentence of some sort? She did get that right. That was of August of 04. Dr. Judy said, I never saw a decrease in her mentation after that point, all the way to the end. Gord Nielsen, same thing. He represented her throughout. Never saw a change or a decrease in her mentation from that point on. Carol Schotte, same thing. Never saw a decrease in her mentation from that point on to the end. The only problem with Rosina was physical. She did struggle physically. We come to May 17th of 06. Here's the scenario. Edward dies. She's got one son left, Alan, who's got cancer, and Alan's living in Minneapolis, the Minneapolis area. Peter lived back here, but she had very little relationship with Peter. And then she's got this Patricia, who's living in Bovee, Minnesota, that wants to move her into this assisted care facility and take control of her, who's seen her twice in 15 years or 14 years or something like that. She's got a problem because the house is sold on a contract for deed. We now have Alan, who's sick, owning an undivided one-half interest, and Edward's four kids owning the other undivided one-half interest. And then she's got this 195 acres left. So what, you know, she's like, what am I going to do? She talks to Gordon Nielsen. Gordon says that we can't do anything about those 80 acres. All you can do is to try to get them bought back. So Rosina, and this is in the summer of 06 after Edward dies, she calls grandson David, who is the most outspoken of all of the grandkids here, and says, I want to buy that back. And Rosina's smart enough here. She even lies to David. She goes, David goes, why? Well, I want to donate to somebody. She over the course of that summer of 06, she made several calls to David to try to get him to sell the land back to her. He deflected the question each time and wouldn't do it. Rosina calls Debbie Snyder, who is the PR of Edward's estate, who also now owns the undivided one-eighth interest, and says, Debbie, I want to buy this land back. Debbie also deflects the question and won't commit to selling it back to Rosina. Debbie's testimony, and I think she used the word anxious, she says, Rosina was very anxious about the fact that there were multiple owners of this property, and Rosina was anxious up to the point, I think it was a couple of weeks before she died. David Stewart also says, yes, Rosina was very troubled by the fact that there were so many owners of this land. So what does Rosina do here? She prepares a codicil. Now, why a codicil? Not a new will. Gord Nielsen said, I wanted to make sure everybody knew that her intent stayed the same from 01 to 06. And all this codicil did, this is absolutely it. It gave Alan's kids, Alan Jr. and Derek, the opportunity to buy the 195 acres for the appraised value of the land from the estate. That was it. And I think their biggest beef in this whole thing is that they feel the land is worth a lot more than what the set number was of $322 an acre. Doesn't matter. We don't know what the land is really worth. We know this. We know that Rosina thought that the appraised value of $322 an acre was too high. There's a letter where Craig Ash writes to Rosina and says, you know, and it's in the file, you know, I realize that you think that this land is overpriced. Anyway, that's the price she picked. How much was it worth in 06? You know, nobody really knows. But that was Rosina's choice. That's what she wanted to do. Now, the question might be, well, you know, why did she pick Alan's side of the family as opposed to Edward's side of the family to have the option to buy this out? Nobody knows what's going through Rosina's mind, but if we think back to that tape, the tape talks about, you know, I'm not going to let Patty have this land because she's just going to sell it off. It's Lynch property, been in the family since 1933. Look at what's going on Edward's side of the family. We've got four kids. She has seen Edward Jr. three times in 15 years. Rebecca, we have no idea. She didn't show up for the probate hearing. Debbie didn't get along with her grandma until maybe the very end, seen her grandma twice or three times in 15 years. Now, David comes more often. How much exactly, we don't know. He wants to rely on what Carol's journal says. Well, Carol's journal says that he was there, I think it's four times in 05 and five times in 06. Now, that's probably not very accurate, but the problem with David is he's in his, I'm not sure, late 40s or something like that, and he's an entrepreneur. And what David said is in June of 06, he came back to see Rosina. Now, this is a month before the codicil is signed. And his exact words were, she was gunning for me. She had heard somewhere that David had this plan to turn the land into a gravel pit. Well, David's defense to her was, look at, and this is Rosina herself. You know, she's having this argument with David a month before the codicil signed. David's argument to her is, look at, a batch plant would cost $200,000, and that just isn't economically feasible. And look, and I'm such a minority interest owner that I couldn't do this by myself. Well, truth or not, what David is planning, the problem is that's going to raise a concern in Rosina's mind about what's going to happen to my land. Now, I don't know what Rosina's thinking, but here's just stepping back, taking a common sense approach. Alan's side of the family has two kids, both boys, both named Stewart. All the people in this, both sides of the family here, there's one person who has moved back to South Dakota, Derek. Derek moved back to South Dakota to go to college in Huron. Huron closed. He went to SDSU and failed algebra. So in the summer of 06, he moves back to go to Sisseton College to take an algebra class. He wants to be a teacher. He appreciates the land for what it is. He was there for Rosina. He would cook with her. He would go get her groceries. He said they'd sit down and they talk about, you know, world events, political events. And she probably is thinking, you know, who is my only hope, who's my only prayer of keeping this land in the family? And so I'm guessing that she decided that's my chance. There's somebody that really appreciates this farm. I'm going to let that side of the family buy it. I want to address in the last minute this medication issue. What Mr. Grach, Rosina was on a number of medications. The way that it would test that her medication was off was just by blood tests. Carol would take her to the doctor regularly. They'd sit and talk for hours. Carol would have no idea that some of her medication would be off. And then a day or two later, they'd call and say, whoops, you know, your blood is too thin. Maybe your thyroid's off a little bit, because those are the only two things that they can test for. And then they'd adjust it. Carol would not have no clue that there was some sort of medication issue, because the medication was not causing a mentation problem, a clear thinking problem. The only way it could happen, and this is the way Dr. Judy said, the only way this could happen is if there was so much swelling in her body, like in her lungs and her heart, that it decreased the oxygen level going to her brain. And then in turn, you know, maybe you could get some confusion. But minutes after there's a confusion, she could be back to normal again and very competent. So I guess I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Strait. Mr. Sutton, you have 5 minutes, sir.
I want to clarify one issue before I follow up with some other ones. With regard to the payments on the contract for deed that, Justice, you asked Mr. Strait about, if you look back in the record, and I think the notes of Carol Schotte that were received as evidence outline it, the record would show that the payments were not made on the contract for deed by the Stewarts until after Carol Schotte was appointed personal the conservator, which was about a year later. I don't believe the contract, there was no showing the contract for deed payment was made, and I don't, or the original down payment, I don't believe that there's, the record indicates that the regular payments were made, and that was part of what she commenced when she began that responsibility. Second, I think the notes also indicate that there weren't any tax returns filed. Rosina hadn't filed tax returns previously, but also hadn't addressed this particular sale issue. Those, to say on the surface that this sale was designed in some format to provide some funding, and I think there's some testimony that the goal was to remodel a house, some of the, I think is clearly inaccurate. And I think the best evidence of that is the fact that there's no payments made under that contract for deed for almost a year, including the down payment. Now, the real problem from at least Peter and Patty's standpoint, with regard to the position that David's clients have, is that all of what David was saying could be true. But the problem with it is, in fact, the $1,000 that were left to each of the two children, the farm could have been kept, or the ranch, or the home could have been kept in the family by providing payments that would go to the other two children. In effect, the net effect and the consequence of that contract for deed coupled in November, coupled with the will, is that 97% of the value went to the two children and 3% went to my clients.
All right, Sutton, you're talking about they think it should have gone differently, but the real issue is testamentary capacity. And
correct.
Didn't the attorney who was involved in the preparation of the will, he felt she was competent, did he not?
But he also took to the extraordinary effort of recording, which he had never done.
But he thought that she was competent.
He testified to that at trial, correct.
What about the witnesses? Did they feel she was competent?
There was some dispute about that. There was dispute. Obviously, Peter had, despite testimony or the statement of Mr. Strait, had significant ongoing contact with his mother during the period of time that she was November.
I'm talking about at the time that they signed as witnesses that she was competent.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't understand what you were asking me. The witnesses who testified at trial did indicate that, in their opinion, that she knew what was going on.
What about the codicil? That involved an intern, I believe, and a secretary at the law office, and they felt that she was competent at the time.
I haven't taken a position on the codicil because, frankly, that doesn't affect my clients.
All right.
That's an issue, frankly, for Mr. Graycheck. But the direct answer to your question is that's true.
And what about her physician? Her physician testified that she was competent.
I don't think her physician testified she was competent in 2004. I believe the testimony was she wasn't providing a lot of medical care to Judy. It was a different physician who was providing care back in 2001. And I think that the conclusion of the court in appointing a personal representative that was a conservator and a guardian, that was in fact a full guardian for about a year and a half, certainly calls into question at least part of the issue of competency.
But that was terminated.
That was terminated in 2004.
As to the conservator.
As to the conservator, and as to the guardian, except she was medically, she was not compliant with her medication. And that, despite everything, is the same reason that Judge Flemmer, in his testimony, said that that continued subsequently. But the noncompliance...
Didn't Judge Flemmer then have... You're saying that based on that evidence, with all the witnesses saying that she was competent, who witnessed the wills and the attorney, Judge Flemmer was clearly erroneous in his decision.
That's the position my clients are taking in. Yes. Any other questions? I guess I have nothing further unless the court has any questions.
Guess not. Thank you, Mr. Sutton. Okay, Mr. Graycheck, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Mr. Graycheck, what about the witnesses on the codicil?
The witnesses all testified that they believe that she had necessary testimony capacity and that she would not suffer from undue influence. Unfortunately, there's no evidence in the record to support their conclusions, because that's what they were, conclusions.
Well, they have to sign as an opinion when they are witnessing the will. That
they
is
do.
The purpose.
They do. But in order to make the determination of whether she suffers from a lack of capacity or whether she's under influence, they need to do more than just sit there, listen to her, say, yeah, that's what I want. Yeah, that's what I want. Sign her name. Because that's what occurred in the codicil signing. There is nothing in the record that she knew the nature of her bounty, that she knew without prompting what property she owned. The only thing they discussed as to the codicil was disposition. Yes, Gordon Nielsen said he was 100% convinced, but that's based on his will signing, maybe, or talking to her during the time of the will, and she going over all that in 2001. In 2006, there was none of that done. They never discussed what property. They never discussed what family she had. All they ever discussed was disposition and the change of disposition. There is no evidence in the record to substantiate capacity in any way. The medication issue. There is a third way to determine if her medications were off. And the record is replete with evidence that her medications were off a lot, especially during the 2006 time frame. And I want to make it clear, Judge Flemmer saw her in 2004 when he changed the guardianship conservatorship issue. That's the last time he saw her. For the next 2 years, he has no idea what happened to her. As a matter of fact, Dr. Judy said, well, after 2004, I couldn't say because I didn't test her. I don't know if she's competent or not after that because I didn't do any testing after that. My conversations with her were very limited. She's hard of hearing. She told me what she wanted to tell me, and that's the best I could do. You know, that's the extent of her testimony. We do have another way to determine if medications are off, though. When the medications are off severely, especially the Lasix medication, she had episodes where she saw children under the bed with guns that weren't there, where she saw a mountain lion behind her stereo wasn't there, where she called the sheriff's department repeatedly claiming that items were being stolen from her house, only to have the guardian come that weekend and find that item stuck in a hall closet somewhere. These are episodes during the year of 2006 that occurred repeatedly throughout the year. We have a guardian testifying that at the time the guardianship was imposed, Rosina was despondent, withdrawn, didn't have the TV on much. That changed, yeah, by 2001, 2002, whatever. She started watching TV, she became more bubbly. By 2004, it was different. However, in 2006, in May of 2006, June or July of 2006, she was again despondent, the same as she was at the time of the guardianship. She wasn't watching the TV, it was off. She was sitting and staring at the walls. This is strong evidence that at that time she was not competent. She did not have the capacity to execute a will. As to the issue of susceptibility of undue influence, I think the strongest evidence is the fact that both the guardian and the doctor testified unequivocally. The one tool they had with Rosina was to negotiate with her about staying home. If you want to stay home, you have to do this.
If you want to stay home, you have to take this medicine. If you want to stay home, you have to go to the nursing home for 3 days. They repeatedly testified that's the only way they could negotiate with her to get what they want from her, bargain with her about her primary goal. As I said, clear evidence that she's subjected to some subjectable to some undue influence. However, I think the strongest evidence that this codicil is not of her making comes from the difference in character in what happened at the time the codicil was executed. For her guardian testified, every time that she testified or every time she had visitors on the weekend, she told me about it when I saw her that week. So-and-so came to see me this week, so-and-so told me this week. Yet if you look at the guardian's notes, there's no indication that she ever said, Alan was home this weekend. The lawyer came out this weekend. I signed papers this weekend. It's completely silent. In fact, the guardian said it was completely silent not only that weekend, but thereafter. Rosina never mentioned the existence of that document to the guardian, even though she had told her her life story and continued to tell her her life story, including the will's existence and what it had in there and why, told her that repeatedly throughout until she died in 2007, never told the guardian, word one, that this codicil existed, what it did, or why. I believe the record substantiates that Judge Former's ruling was erroneous, and we would ask this court to reverse that decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graycheck. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.